The following Dharma talk was given at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Once again, welcome to our Sunday morning group. The talk today, I'm calling The Body as Home. Next weekend, I'm going to be doing a workshop with Ramesh Sareen. He's a geriatric psychiatrist and works with patients in a lot of chronic pain, both mental pain and physical pain, and we're both very interested in embodiment and how we relate wisely to the body. And it's interesting because I think many of us come to Buddhist practice because we're suffering, and I think we rightly intuit that suffering is in the mind, that suffering somehow as a result of relating in a limited way to our conditions, and maybe a way that doesn't fully comprehend or fully see, isn't fully wise. So I think that is a correct intuition, that suffering is in the mind. Why is it then, in this Buddhist path, that there is so much emphasis on embodiment, on attending to the body? So this is a question. This is an interesting question. John Donahue, an Irish poet that I like a lot, he says, "It's our minds that make our lives so homeless." So I really like this idea of seeing the body as home, as unpleasant and as scary as the body can be this time. How can we feel at home in the body, and how can the body be our teacher? So most of us don't enter Buddhist practice with the intention of becoming intimate with the body, right? I mean, we have a tendency to write the body off in some ways. The body is sort of boring. We've been in this body forever, and it's a nuisance sometimes. You know, so we can have relationship to the body that is not so much driven by investigation, and we certainly don't see it as a pathway to freedom. And I'm wondering too, just even in this short sit that we did together, how is it that we bounce out of the body? We can have the intention to land in the sensations of the body, but why is it so difficult to stick there? Because it is, right? We go into our thinking. And I think one thing that it's important to recognize is that our suffering is illuminated through the body. Right, when we're feeling angry, when we're feeling anxious, when we're feeling bound, there's an accompanying sensation on a physical level. And when we sink into the body, that's what we feel. And so if you showed up this morning with some anxiety, a little bit like I did, you go into the body, and you might just bounce right back out because that's like an unpleasant place. So we kind of have to recognize these habits of mind in relationship to difficult sensation. Yeah, I was thinking this morning, even as I woke up, my first thought was, oh, you have to give a talk today. You're giving a talk today. And there was sort of, this just sort of like familiar wash, you know, this shrill sense that we get in the belly. And my response was, Benedict Cumberbatch was on Saturday Night Live last night. And see if I can catch a few clips, right? That was the feeling, like, I just need to refresh, I need to relax, I need to just sort of do this thing before I face this thing, right? So this is this bouncing off. Body isn't home, body is uncomfortable, and we depart. And in this day and age, that departure, that distraction is so available to us, isn't it? Like, just with our virtual worlds, it's so available. So I feel like this is a particular challenge to our time. I want to start with reading an interesting article. It's called Touching Enlightenment. Reggie Ray Takes on the Modern Crisis of Disembodiment. This was from a very long article in Tricycle magazine from 2006. Reggie Ray is a teacher from the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, but I feel like what he has to say really applies to our tradition also. So I just have about one page that I've extracted from this very long article, mostly just the beginning of the article. So these are his reflections. I feel like they're both provocative and useful. He writes, "During my own practice and teaching of meditation over the past 35 years, many things have surprised me, but none more than the growing and somewhat anguished realization that simply practicing meditation doesn't necessarily yield results. Many of us, when we first encountered Buddhism, found its invitation to freedom and realization through meditation extraordinarily compelling. We jumped in with a lot of enthusiasm, rearranged life priorities around meditation, and put much time and energy into practice. But if we've been practicing for 20 or 30 years, or even just a few, it's not uncommon to find ourselves in quite a troubling place. We may feel that somewhere along the line, we have lost track of what we are doing and that things have somehow gotten bogged down. We may find that the same old habitual patterns continue to grip us, the same disquieting emotions, the same interpersonal blockages and basic life confusion, the same unfulfilled and agonized spiritual longing that led us to meditation in the first place keeps arising. Was our inspiration defective? Is there something wrong with the practices or the traditions we are following?" In an early Theravadin meditation text, the phrase, "touching enlightenment with the body," is used to describe the attainment of ultimate spiritual realization. It is interesting, if a bit puzzling, that we are invited not to see enlightenment, but to touch it. Not with our thought or our mind, but with our body. What can this possibly mean? In what way can the body be thought to play such a central and fundamental role in the life of meditation? This question becomes all the more interesting and compelling in our contemporary context, where so many people are acutely feeling their own personal disembodiment. My sense is that there is a very real problem among Western Buddhist practitioners. We are attempting to practice meditation and to follow a spiritual path in a disembodied state, and our practice is therefore doomed to failure. The full benefits and fruition of meditation cannot be experienced or enjoyed when we are not grounded in our bodies. The phrase from the early text, when understood fully, implies not only that we are able to touch enlightenment with our bodies, but that we must do so. That in fact, there is no other way to touch enlightenment except in and through our bodies. When we operate in a disembodied state, we tend to understand the experiences of our life as random, relatively insignificant, and boring. We go to great lengths to try to find something interesting or significant in our life. The more boring and gray everything gets, the more we look to sex or violence or mind-altering substances or anything that can give us some kind of rush. According to the Yogacara teachings of Indian Buddhism, the problem with our life does not lie in the individual circumstances or occurrences of our day-to-day existence. It's not that they're inherently meaningless and boring. The problem is we make them meaningless and boring because we are so invested in maintaining our own sense of self. We actually don't relate to anything in a direct way. Unwilling to fully live the life that is arriving in our bodies moment by moment, we find ourselves left with no real life at all. I really like that statement, that we're left with no real life at all. And this is my experience, you know, that leaning out of my center. I always appreciate that James Joyce quote from the Dubliners, "Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body." Mm. And there's just a few more lines from Reggie Ray. In the classical Buddhist traditions, meditation is deeply somatic. It is fully grounded in sensations, sensory experience, feeling, emotions, and so on. Even thoughts are related to as somatic, as bursts of energy experienced in the body, rather than non-physical phenomenon that disconnect us from our bodies. In its most ancient Buddhist form, meditation is a technique for letting go of the objectifying tendency of thought and of entering deeply and fully into communion with our embodied experience. And hence it leads to touching enlightenment with the body. So I feel like culturally we have an interesting relationship with our body, like, because I think there is actually no shortage of attention into the body, even obsession with the body, but it has to do with our agendas for the body, how the body looks. You know, we have a kind of cultural obsessiveness with youth, with beauty. You know, a bad hair day can unhinge us, right? But how often do we move through the day with an awareness of our liver or our kidney, you know, or the skin and the sole of the foot? You know, so there's this sort of imbalance that comes with our agendas, which are fueled with our beliefs about what is the source of our happiness. So this leads me to wise and unwise attention. So mindfulness has particular characters, right? As I tried to suggest during our opening meditation, can we receive the body with an attitude of kindness, openness, equanimity, right? It's receptive, it's non-interfering, non-manipulative, non-controlling, non-rejecting. So we want to sort of push away what we don't like. We want to draw in what we like. So this is radical. This is a radical holding of the attention, a radical kind of awareness with which we receive experience, with which we show up in the present moment. Otherwise, and these are Marcia Rose's words, otherwise we rest in the inertia of our habits. Without a fresh awareness, we live in our habits. I think often of my early years as a dancer, developing developmentally, a 22-year-old, like that time in my life, many of our lives, is like a difficult time when we're sort of figuring things out. And it was a really difficult time for me, and I moved to New York, and training, trying to be this dancer, and I was coming up against so much fear. Like, there was just, it felt like just patterns of fear that were quite debilitating in my aspiration. Like, even in a dance class, moving across the floor was just such a source of self-consciousness, much less performing. Performing was so, it was so painful, just being plagued by fear, by self-consciousness. And this was so painful. And we all know the pain of self-consciousness, right? We all know that. And it became such a sort of crisis for me, you know, like really trying to work with it, really trying to work with my mind, just in every way imaginable, that wasn't working. But what that led me to do was to turn to meditation at that time, redirect the awareness into that fear. I got really interested, actually, what is self-consciousness about? You know, what is it about? What are these forces? Felt like I didn't make them. They were just showing up. They were showing up in my experience. They were dictating my life in many ways. So I got really interested and motivated. And so I moved into the Integral Yoga Institute in New York City. It's kind of, yeah, this wonderful place where we got up every morning at 5 a.m. and we chanted and did sadhana until 7 a.m. and did my yoga. And I, you know, and the whole guru thing, all that was, it wasn't about that for me. I just felt there was something intuitively that I understood. I had to quiet down. had to settle down and I had to pay attention to what was going on. There needed to be a listening, a kind listening, and that's what I learned. So for the first time, it was like, okay, in the stillness of my body, the instruction was pay attention to the breath. Just watch the breath. Okay, that I can trust. That doesn't give rise to doubt. I'm not needing to worship anything. I can pay attention to the breath. And with that backdrop of coming into the body, fear could arise, and then fear could be observed. And it could be observed in intricate detail. And I could feel it as a tangle, and I could get to know it, and I could stop fearing fear. I could stop hating fear, just seeing it as a force of its own. So this is sort of remarkable thing about the Buddhist practice, right? We learn to step into the space of awareness which is separate from the affliction. It's separate from the affliction. It's a place where we can rest. It's a place that doesn't have boundaries. We can't measure the space of the mind, right? We can't measure our awareness. It doesn't have an age. It doesn't have a gender. And it's not personal. It's just the space of awareness that can receive those energies of self-hatred, that can receive those energies of fear, and get to know them, and meet them with kindness. And that was the other sort of unexpected and necessary piece of being in this small community in the Integral Yoga Institute, where, you know, just sitting in this room at 5 a.m, you know, there was a sweetness to all these bodies around me who at first I didn't know, but just kind of wrapped in their shawls and the little candlelight and the room that was lovingly painted this ugly blue, you know, whatever. It was just, but there was such a kindness in the intention that helped too. That helped me to kind of see these patterns of self-hatred as separate from myself. So it's just a little plug for Sangha, a little plug for the support of Sangha as we sort of rework these deep patternings of mind and body. So this is a beautiful thing, you know, that there was an emphasis on the somatic experience, the felt experience. You know, the Buddha emphasized that in particular, because in particular, it precisely mirrors the mind. So by knowing the body, we can know the mind. So that's, you know, hearing is important, seeing is important, all the foundations of mindfulness are important. But the sensory body has this particular gift of revealing the nature of what's happening in the mind. And so, yeah, so slowly at that time, I was learning how to show up without resistance into my experience, without resistance. So it's like rejecting nothing about however this moment shows up. So once we taste that, we recognize the freedom. We recognize the freedom in that. And I also recognized how exhausting it is to resist that. How exhausting it is to not be in our center, to become, as the Buddha said, you know, we have the desire to become, we want to become something. And that's like Mr. Duffy, just outside the body. We're not anchored here because we're on our way always to something better that we imagine will be the source of our final gratification. So just recognizing the cost when we wall off from ourselves, like we could say, like in my little experience of wanting to watch Saturday Night Live, like there's some innocence to that, there's some sweetness to that, but if that becomes a life strategy, right, we wall off our life, we are walled off from our basic life energy. Tara Brach calls this, she calls the experience of the body as a wilderness. And I really like that. Just because of the, you know, when we experience the body in a way that's not mediated by our images of the body or our words about the body, when we're just in that flow of sensation, it's a wild ride. And it's, the flow of impermanence becomes clear as we settle into sensation not mediated by our ideas. And also, this idea of non-self, you know, I feel like it's sort of a, you know, it's difficult to talk about this sort of idea of non-self, and I don't think it's useful as a concept to hold. But as we enter the wilderness of the body, it's like, and enter the space of awareness that receives the wilderness of the body, it's interesting in the concentration of that experience, it's like there's no center to it. You know, there's no self that's guiding the whole thing. So I think that this sense of self, I don't think it's good to think about it too much. I think it's good just to do the practice because it chips away slowly these assumptions about what the self is. It just chips it away, and wisdom creeps in. Yeah. And Ajahn Sumedho, he uses the words that I often did this morning about receiving the body, that we don't even need to direct the mind. We just need to not distract the mind. If we not distract the mind, we can just receive the body. And to let the body do its dance, you know, it's not like we have to say, now I'm going to pay attention to this contraction that I'm feeling here or whatever. The body just calls itself up. We don't need to be managers. And also, you know, we can't turn the body off. That's the thing. You know, and it also is what makes it a good teacher. So for me, I really try, in moments in my life, I want to write off, like standing in line or sitting in traffic. It's a moment I just want to get through. I'm training myself to instead direct the attention to the body in those moments and treat it, like Sharon Salzberg said, as an adventure in consciousness, you know? Enter the wilderness. Let this moment be lived. This is Reggie Ray again. He says, these days there's much talk about creating effective personal boundaries. But the interesting point is that you can't actually put up boundaries around your body. The boundaries happen up top, in the head. The body is open. The body is sensitive. The body is vulnerable. The body is intelligent. And the body is completely beyond judgment. From the body's viewpoint, whether we like or dislike what is occurring in the world is irrelevant. Whatever occurs in our environment, the body receives. We could speak of the rejected experience, the somatic knowledge that we wall off, as our unlived life. It is that part of our human existence, and often a very large part, that we do not feel, engage, accommodate, or incorporate. And these are the Buddha's words. There is one thing that, when cultivated and regularly practiced, leads to deep spiritual intention, to peace, to mindfulness and clear comprehension, to vision and knowledge, to a happy life here and now, and to the culmination of wisdom and awakening. And what is that one thing? It is mindfulness centered on the body. And elsewhere he writes, if the body is not cultivated, the mind cannot be cultivated. If the body is cultivated, then the mind can be cultivated. And he has a very useful metaphor for when afflictions rise in the mind. If a desire, like an unwholesome desire or a kind of hatred, whatever it might be, arises in the mind, if we're grounded in the body, there's a kind of protection. There's a grounding. And the Buddha's metaphor is, it would be like a ball of yarn being thrown at a hard door, that's the kind of imprint it will make. It makes no imprint at all, right? just hits the door and floats off. So with mindfulness grounded in the body, that hatred can't make an imprint in the same way. If mindfulness is not grounded in the body, if you took a stone and threw it into soft clay, that's the kind of imprint that hatred will make in the mind or in the body. So it's a big imprint, right? And that's interesting too, like whatever gets printed on the mind gets printed somatically in the body. You know, we hold our traumas. Yeah, and so we have our formal practice to sit down and just open and receive and practice non-judgment, kind of cultivating our refuge. But I think too about how our daily life practice is supported by our body, like this body that we carry around with us all day long. It's always here. It's always a place we can sink into as a form of practice. Last weekend I was standing at a table at the Veggie Fest at the University of Minnesota. I'm a state council member of the Humane Society of the United States, where I just kind of try and encourage legislation that will be protecting to animals. And but anyway, it's this new sort of thing I'm doing. So I showed up at this Veggie Fest not knowing what to expect, and kind of having a lot of doubt. You know, is this a good use of my? You know, I was feeling anxious. I had a lot to do that day. So, you know, is this good? Is this good social action? Is this, you know, just, and also feeling like I didn't know what I was talking about that much. So kind of in talking to the people, it's like I don't really know what I'm talking about. And I wasn't saying that, but that was just sort of my. It was just my vibe, like, you know. And so there was a lot of uncertainty and just the nature of this doing this table is like we're trying to get people to sign up their email and stuff. And so there was this thing of reaching out to people, which I sort of have an aversion to, like, you know, kind of engaging people. And then I noticed, I just started looking at my watch. I was like, okay, I'm done. I just want out. I'm done, you know. So that was fueled both by the unpleasantness of these engaged, you know, and the doubt, like, should I be here? So those things were all playing. But then I, you know, it's like then practice kicks in, like, oh, yeah, I'm suffering here. I want out, you know. It's like that's a red flag that but if ever you're saying I want out, turn in, you know. It's like, yes. And so with that red flag, I just kind of, okay, just go to your body. And here I'm talking to this woman. And I'm just noticing, oh my God, there's so much tension in the throat, there's so much tension in the smile, there's just this whole world in the wilderness going on. And it kind of gave rise to a compassion, right? Like, ooh, honey, this is hard for you, you know? And so, you know, and then just all of a sudden making that space, getting interested, making that space. And all of a sudden this woman in front of me, instead of being this object of my aversion, I'm suddenly interested, you know, she's included in that adventure in consciousness of like, what's happening, you know? And all of a sudden she's a shifting form, a personality, and, you know, and everything is enlivened. So when we're not resisting the moment, when we can show up, we can be present, it's enlivening, you know, even if it's unpleasant. Like that dip into my body to feel these multiple contractions, it's not a pleasant dip, right? It's like, ugh. But, you know, I know better now than to just kind of keep looking at my watch and just saying, I want out, you know. So you turn in, embrace the mess. You know, otherwise, if we always want out, then our lives become really narrow and we have to control everything so that it pleases us, so we never get to feel uncomfortable. Steve Armstrong, I love his words, comfort is not a worthy goal. Mm. Yeah. So embracing the mess. I want to read a few sentences by Gil Fronsdale. He says, during my early Vipassana practice in Thailand, Ajahn Buddhadasa said at the opening of a 10-day retreat, do not do anything that takes you out of your body. Over those 10 days, I frequently reached forward to grasp or identify with something outside myself. When I remembered this, for me, puzzling instruction, I began to realize how often my center of attention and gravity was projected just in front of me, Mr. Duffy. Right? The more I settled into my body, the more sensitive I became to ever subtler movements away from that center, due to even subtler attachments and aversions of the mind. Gradually, I learned that mindfulness of the body is one of the best windows I have into my inner life. I just want to end with this short poem by Rumi, and then we'll open the discussion. So this is called The Guest House, Rumi is referring to the guest house simply as being human, but I also like to think of the guest house actually as our body, as our embodied experience. So this is what he says. This being human is a guest house. Every morning, a new arrival, a joy, a depression, a meanness. Some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. So I thought we could just talk about our experience, our challenges of being in a body, our relationship to the body, and how we view our body in terms of spiritual practice. Or if you have any questions, any comments that came up for you, just be great to hear.
I'm Peggy. I want to know if you ever went back to dancing.
Oh. I'm still dancing. Yeah, it's my career. Thank you. But, you know, it could have stopped me in my tracks. You know, it could have stopped me in my tracks.
I've got it, so I guess I usually don't, but I will say something. I'm Cynthia, and I just want to say how much I appreciate your touching on and focusing on emotions, because I often leave here confused about where that fits into the whole picture. So thank you for that very much.
Yeah, thank you so much, Wen. I've been reading some Reggie Ray, not a lot of him yet, and thinking a lot about more embodied practice after years and years of just keep going back to my breath. And I'm feeling like I'm reading about so many different practices that I sit down and it's like, oh, should I sink into the earth now? No, that feels like I'm being covered by the earth. That's one of the things he teaches. I'm thinking more about how I can have a more embodied sitting practice, because I feel I know more about how to be in my body when I'm moving and dancing and doing daily life. It's my sitting practice that's just all over the place now. And this might be a question that takes like an 8-week course at least, but maybe you have a few thoughts on the way in on that, because I've mostly done my breath practice for many, many years.
I mean, the thought that comes to my mind is, it's like, what interests you when you sit? You know, it's like, I think if we have the attitude that the body doesn't have much to offer, you know, the investigation of the body is just sort of limited, then I think the mind will always be more interesting. It will always be more sexy, you know, and we'll always want to drift. We'll always sort of. But I think once we feel the refuge of being in the body, you know, once we recognize it as a safe haven, I think that that sort of is a tipping point for our willingness to show up in the body. And this just brings me to, you know, what I alluded to briefly around unpleasantness. You know, this is Vedana. You know, the Buddha instructed us to pay attention to feeling, pleasant and unpleasant. And that can be confusing at first. Why is pleasant and unpleasant so meaningful? It's because pleasant and unpleasant lead us around unconsciously. So, and I think that's the particular trip and trick of the body, is that it's often unpleasant. We can feel terrible about our sickness. We can feel terrible about growing old. We can have so many things about not wanting to land in the body. So I think that can be a real, just a real turning point in practice, in understanding the real value of the body. And I think it's a natural anchor when we don't resist the moment. You know, that moment of presence, it is inclusive of the body. It's inclusive of all the sense gates. When we show up with that enlivened presence, there's nothing that's being excluded. So part of that is finding that taste of what is presence. Because then you'll just find that the body is naturally appearing. It's not like we have to sit down and meditate and direct my attention, you know, which can be a trip in itself.
I'm glad I came today. My name is Roseanne. Thank you, Wynn. That's a great lesson. I feel like you touched on so many points that I relate to. I feel like you've been following me around, like, for the last 24 hours. I actually did run away flee from somebody last night in a very correct way, but I was one of those circumstances where I felt that discomfort. And I actually did come home, and after I watched Benedict Cumberbatch, I did even I did even watch some cat videos, because I had heard President Obama make a reference to it in some interview with Samantha Bee. But in any case, so I'm getting my dirty laundry out here. But I've been sort of in and out of Buddhist practice for many years, sticking my toes in the pond, and this past year I'm committing to more to it. And I realized after your talk, which was very relevant to me today, is that I really am clueless about my body's role in this practice and how wonderful that I can have a refreshed, suggestions from you about proceeding with that exploration. But the first, I want to make sure you said something at the beginning of our sitting that I didn't mishear it. But you had said something about letting go of the diaphragmatic breathing, did you actually make that reference?
Letting go of sometimes what I was trying to say, that sometimes when we support an upright posture, we think that our breath, you know, we can use muscles in a way that constrict the breath.
Right.
So I was just trying to say, how can we come to a supported posture that doesn't in any way constrain the diaphragm?
Okay, so I did hear that correctly, because I'm a trained singer. And I think when you said that, I thought, wow, you mean after all, 30 years of voice training, I'm supposed to let go of my diaphragmatic breathing? Which is the thing that when I get in my sitting and I'm kind of lost, I say, well, just sit up straight and take a nice low diaphragmatic breath. And that'll kind of, and it was kind of when you said that, I thought, it reminded me of being at the doctor years ago, and when he said, I'm checking your heart, take a deep breath. I took a big diaphragmatic breath. I was going to impress him. And he said, okay, now do that again and just let go, relax, and just fill up the lungs naturally. And I thought, gee, okay. That's simple, huh? And that's kind of the feeling I had about it, is that I think in my first, it was kind of a good thing for me to know today, because I think I do attach myself, or I have on occasion, to that something I'm familiar with, which is, okay, I can attach to the way I breathe, and that's going to lead me into enlightenment. So thank you very much. That's just a simple thought I had.
Yeah. No, and it's great, these subtle identities. Right? That we hold. Beautiful. Thank you. Okay, one more, and then we have the children here. So maybe one more. Was there? Oh, I'm sorry. Go for it. Yeah.
So I came in with a lot of discursive thought, and then when we weren't chanting, I saw my mind just go right to grasping. And it did it for like 10 minutes, and I watched it.
Oh, like because the chant got forgotten?
So the habit energy. Where is it? And I wasn't going to let it go. And I thought, I even was going to do this. I was going to hold it up, you know. And I thought, no. And I even did this. I actually put it out in front of me. No, put it down. So I watched this funny game. It really was funny. And so I was able to go to that place of first. Okay, sorry about that. Anyway, so I finally was able to let go of it after a lot of dancing of my own. So that's it.
All right, the kids are here. Okay, guys, come on in.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.